I call this meeting of the Judiciary Committee to order. Members and staff, this is our third remote hearing that we are live streaming. And before we get started, I'd like to go over a few things before we start official business. We are holding this remote hearing pursuant to House Rule 10.01, passed on the floor on March 26, 2020, which allows for remote hearings to take place during this declared peacetime emergency. The rule is a sunset provision of January 31st, 2021. So quick review, since it's been a week since we've had the remote hearing procedure. Members, please default to mute. Keep yourself on mute when you're not voting or speaking. And there's a new tip. While you are on mute, you can hold down your space bar to become unmuted. So long as you are holding down the space bar, the moment you let it go, you will become muted again. So it's kind of a handy feature to make sure that you are automatically muted, but you can be heard at the time that you need to speak. If you're on your computer, you can unmute yourself on the bottom left portion of your screen. The same goes with turning off and on your camera. Committee staff can mute and unmute you and will assist when we move to voting. For those who call into Zoom, remember, you must hit *6 to unmute. And I'm going to say that again. You need to hit *6 to unmute, because if we go to you and we hear nothing, we will move on to the next one. So remember, if you're calling in, to hit *6. Please use the raise your hand function on the bottom of your screen. You should be able to click on participants, and a tool opens up on the right side of your screen that shows everyone who's in the meeting. And at the bottom of the participants, there's a button labeled raise your hand. So click on that if you wish to be recognized. Do not lower your hand, because committee staff needs to get to that, take it down, and then you'll be on the list just as we are in any typical meeting. Please do not use the reaction function of a thumbs up or clapping, as they'll disappear and they're difficult to track. Just use the raise your hand function. Here's another new tip. If you're on the phone, you can hit *9 to raise your hand, or you can email Rachel Ganani or Jenna Mouse, the CA and the CLA respectively, in order to be recognized to get on the list to speak. And thank you for being patient with us. We'll be taking breaks periodically to make sure we don't miss anything or anyone. Now, after consultation with Republicans, we'll be moving towards doing procedural motions and adopting author's amendments via voice vote. We'll continue to do roll calls on each vote that refers a bill to the general register or another committee. As is always the case, any member can request a roll call on any vote. I've been notified that a quorum is present. The committee legislative assistant will take the roll.
Chair Lesh.
Present.
Representative Moeller.
Present.
Representative Scott.
Here.
Representative Albright.
Present.
Representative Barr.
Here.
Representative Cantrell.
Here.
Representative Carlson.
Here.
Representative Considine.
Here.
Representative Hassan.
Here.
Representative Herr.
Present.
Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Liebling. Representative Liebling. Representative Lucero.
It's a great day in the basement.
Representative Mariani. Representative Mariani. Representative Knorr.
Present.
Representative O'Neill.
Present.
Representative Robbins.
Present.
Representative Zhang.
Present.
Okay, members, today we will be hearing three bills. The first is House File 3812. That's Representative Noor's. That's the Child Protection DHS policy bill. We're going to be adopting a DE amendment, and the motion will be recommended to re-refer it to HHS Finance. Remember, this is the one that we handled a few weeks ago in actual committee, in the committee room itself. And there were some issues brought up by a constituent group, and my understanding is they're working it out with the DE amendment. The second bill will be House File 4571. That's the bill of which I am the chief author. It's a forfeiture reform bill. We'll be adopting the A1 and the A2 author amendments. The motion will be recommended to be re-referred to State Government Finance. This is a clone bill moving from Public Safety to Ways and Means. There is a clone bill in any case doing that. This was the product of a grand compromise that was achieved by both sides. They put a lot of work and effort into it. They didn't please everyone, as has happened. There are some malcontents, but in any case, it represents a great compromise. We're prepared to move forward on. The third bill is House File 3563, Representative Moran. Child support table modification will be adopting the DE-7 amendment. The motion will be to recommend to re-refer to HHS Finance. But our first matter for today is approval of minutes of April 16th. So I will move those. We'll be doing a voice vote on the minutes. Vice Chair Mahler has reviewed the minutes, and she makes the motion to approve the minutes of April 16th. Is that correct, Chair Mahler? Right, Vice Chair yes. Mahler?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Any discussion? Then all in favor of the minutes as proposed of April 16th, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. The motion prevails, and the minutes of April 16th are adopted and approved. So the first bill we have up today is House File 3812, Representative Noor, Child Protection DHS Policy Bill. This bill was laid over at a committee on March 10th. The purpose was to give the author, DHS, and outside advocate agencies to get together and try and reach some consensus language. We're going to take up HF 3812 today. Representative Noor moves that House File 3812 be recommended to be re-referred to HHS Policy Committee. And we have the DE A20-0738 author amendment. Representative Noor, now that we have the bill before us again, you'll move that A20-0378 amendment. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. But do we need to take the bill from the table from the last session?
So that's a great question. Ms. Ganani, going back to what we did, are we simply taking this bill off the table? That I laid it on the table, is that right? Well, here's what I'm going to do. It's been publicly noticed, Representative Noor, and it is in our possession. I will make that motion to take it off the table in case that's what we need to do, because I don't have those other minutes before us. So all in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed say no. The bill is now before us again. So Representative Noor, I will move your A20-0738 amendment. Why don't you go ahead?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is the bill that we discussed a few weeks ago, and we have reached an agreement, and we do have an amendment that puts the bill in the shape that all the stakeholders have agreed on. So this bill enables the tribes and counties to enter into written agreement that will allow for a transfer of responsibility for the screening, an initial response to a child maltreatment report regarding an Indian child who is a resident of the county where the Indian child's reservation is located from the county to the tribe. This bill authorizes unaccompanied minors experiencing homelessness to consent to homeless youth services and or services for sexually exploited youth. Currently, homeless youth service providers and providers of service for sexually exploited youth do not have legal authority to provide services to minors without parental consent. Parents and guardians retain legal custody over their minor children. This does not infringe upon their legal custody. Child protective services through court orders can also exercise legal and physical custody over minors. This bill contains provisions that will bring the state into compliance with federal Family First Prevention Services Act before its effective nationwide on October 21, 2021. There have been significant.
So, Representative Norm, you're not speaking to just the amendment now, is that
right? I'm speaking to the amendment of the bill because it's a DE, Mr. Chair.
You are, okay. Excellent. Thank you.
The bill's provisions related to QRTPs, which the Deputy Assistant Commissioner will cover. So, this is the amendment that we have in front of you. I just wanted to ask for your support to get the bill in the shape that we want.
Great. Any discussion from members of the committee? Any discussion? Okay, then we're going to adopt the 820-0738 amendment. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed say no. The motion prevails, the amendment is adopted. So we have someone, I believe, who's interested in testifying in support of the bill as amended. Lisa Bailey, Deputy Assistant Commissioner, DHS. Ms. Bailey, are you here?
I am, thank you.
Excellent.
Can you hear me? Okay.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee for allowing us to come back. I won't go over everything again as we had already addressed this earlier, but just want to thank you for the opportunity. We worked with members of NAMI and
Ms. Bailey?
Yes.
Can you go ahead and just begin by introducing yourself for the record into, please?
I apologize. Yes. Lisa Bailey. I'm the Deputy Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services at the Department of Human Services.
Thank you. Please proceed.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And if you'll recall, when we met last in March, there were concerns raised by NAMI and Aspire Minnesota, in particular about the portion addressing the qualified residential treatment programs. Since that date, we have met with both of those groups and come up with an agreement, essentially, which removes the voluntary foster care for treatment provisions under Chapter 260D entirely from the portion of the bill that we're working on here. And if you'll recall, the whole reason for bringing this forward was to bring the state into compliance with the Federal Family First Prevention Services Act. And by removing this, it gives the department, counties, tribes, and advocates an opportunity to meet with stakeholders over the next year, which is we have another year and a half or so before Family First goes into effect, to consider how we can address their concerns and also to consider the funding options, because once we remove those voluntary treatment options, placement options from that portion of the bill, they're no longer eligible for Family First or the federal 4E reimbursement funding. So this will give us an opportunity to move forward with implementing the Family First portions of the act and at the same time to address the concerns of the stakeholders.
Excellent. Thank you, Ms. Bailey, for those comments and for working with the stakeholder groups to help make this happen as well, too. Any other questions or comments from any other members of the committee? I'm not seeing any on my list. So were there any closing comments that you wanted to make, Representative Noor, to House File 3812 as amended?
No further comments, Mr. Chair. I will ask for your support to send this bill. I believe it goes to HHS policy before it goes to the General Register. Is that correct, Mr. Chair?
That's correct. The motion is to move it to HHS policy, Representative Noor. So we will vote on that motion then. The clerk will take the roll to referring House File 3812 as amended to HHS policy. Chair votes aye.
Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Albright.
Aye.
Representative Barr.
Aye.
Representative Cantrell.
Aye.
Representative Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Considine.
Aye.
Representative Hassan.
Aye.
Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Lucero.
Yes.
Representative Mariani.
Yes.
Representative Noor.
Yes.
Representative O'Neill.
Aye.
Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Representative Zhang.
Yes.
On a vote of 18, I'm sorry, a vote of 17 ayes and zero nays, the motion prevails. The bill as amended is referred to HHS Finance. Thank you very much, Representative Noren, and nice job on working that out. Oh, it's not? I hear you shaking your head.
Policy.
It's referred to HHS policy. Thank you for that correction. Thank you, Representative Noren. The next bill we'll be hearing is going to be House File 4571, the Forfeiture Reform Bill. I move that House File 4571 be recommended to be referred to State Government Finance. The A1 and A2 amendments should be with everyone. I have the A1 amendment. This just delays the effective date, which was a Department of Public Safety request, and cleans up some phrasing. So we'll move up to, unless there are questions, are there any questions about it? Otherwise, we'll move to a voice vote on the A1 amendment. I don't see any. So all in favor of the A1 amendment to House File 4571, signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed say no. Motion passes. The A1 is adopted. The A2 amendment I offer, and that's before us, it's a file technical change which was caught yesterday afternoon. It's really just, it cleans up some language in the notice of seizure warning. So reps, this was late, but I asked Representative Scott about this and she said that it was okay with her. So we'll move to a voice vote on adopting the A2 amendment, but I'll wait a minute to see if there are any questions about this. Are there any questions about the A2 amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Chair Liebling.
Just sorry, but just to note, we probably need to give everyone a moment or remind everyone to unmute their lines before we do these voice votes, because I'm noticing that a lot of folks aren't catching up quick enough to actually get a vote in.
Got it. That's a good point. I'll slow down a little bit on that too, Chair Liebling. I don't see any questions on the A2 amendment, so making note of Chair Liebling's point about unmuting your lines. All in favor of the A2 amendment, signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, say no. The A2 amendment is adopted. Motion passes. So, members, now that we have the bill before us as amended by the A1 and the A2 amendments, I wanted to know, this bill is the product of a lot of stakeholders that work together with a mediator. They actually brought in a mediator for this to reach consensus language. And I want to note that I really appreciate the work that was put in by the stakeholders on this. It's not easy to arrive at consensus on this, and not everyone gets what they want. And I would note that I want, whether it's myself or other members around this table this year, to make note of the folks who participated and took ownership in the difficult process that it took to arrive at consensus on this, because those folks, in my opinion, get additional credibility in future years and future bills, because it shows a willingness to do what we need to do to reach an agreement up here at the Capitol. So the coalition of the stakeholders include the Justice Action Network, the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, the State Drug Task Force, the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and the State Patrol, the State Public Defender's Office, the ACLU of Minnesota, Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, Legal Aid, Americans for Prosperity, and the Sheriff's Association. So there are four major changes to the current law. I'll just go through the highlights. There are changes to the DWI forfeiture law, changes to controlled substances forfeitures, changes to federal sharing program, and changes to transparency and reporting. So I have testifiers here to explain the bill more in depth. Bill Ward and Bob Small will start us off and discuss how the group worked together. Nora Stanseed and Howard Bass will discuss the details of the bill, and Ron Elwood will be available to answer questions about the repealer. So let's go ahead and just get started. As a reminder to the testifiers, please state your name and title for the record. And Mr. Ward, we will start with you. And I understand you're going to talk to us about the process of how the group worked together.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is William Ward. I'm the State Public Defender. I do appreciate your remarks because you pretty much took away what I was going to say to introduce the other speakers.
I'm sorry.
No worries. I'll be very brief. Many of you do not realize this, but my office does not represent individuals in forfeiture proceedings of the folks that we represent. The difficulty about that is the vast majority of all forfeitures are levied against the impoverished. And the amounts are relatively small in our standards, perhaps, but very large for the impoverished. But yet the amounts are on the lower side, where it costs more to hire a lawyer to fight the forfeiture proceeding than to not fight it at all. So we've been working with all of the stakeholders you just described, Chair Lesh, and we got more involved in this the last couple of sessions, and especially last year, where there was a desire perhaps to merge the civil forfeiture proceedings with the criminal proceedings so my office could assist individuals who didn't otherwise have the ability to fight these forfeitures. We learned through those discussions, we learned through all of our discussions and in talking with many of you, that the idea of implementing and taking a civil proceeding and merging it to a criminal one was going to be very difficult and would be resource intensive, especially for my agency and also for the county attorney's office. Based upon that discussion of last session, we knew that we had to come up with a better plan because many people, both sides of the aisle, realized that the forfeiture law as it currently exists needs to change. So I appreciate Judge Small, the County Attorneys Association, reaching out to Justice Action Network, reaching out, and of course the ACLU and the other individuals you described. With that, we started off with the larger group trying to get a sense as to what the priorities were. We oftentimes met in smaller groups to discuss if we could work out certain details that others had concerns on. And ultimately, we came up with a pretty decent framework, but we couldn't quite get to the place we needed to be. And it's for that reason, as you described earlier, we literally went to mediation to see if we could work together to get over the humps that people had concerns about. And those of you who know mediation know that what comes out of that is nobody's happy, but something positive resulted as a result of those discussions and the meetings themselves. So ultimately, after the mediation, we continue to meet as a body, as a committee to try to work this out. And that's what you have before you is a bill that has wonderful merits to it. It will deal with, it'll keep cases from coming into the system and ultimately will protect people from their personal property and currency being taken away from them when they didn't otherwise have an opportunity to fight that on their own if they are represented by my office. So I will yield at this point and allow Judge Small to have any comments that he has.
Thank you very much for your comments, Mr. Ward. Mr. Small?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robert Small, and I am the executive director of the County Attorneys Association. Chair Lesh, thank you very much for that introduction because you've reduced my testimony to about two sentences, as well as Mr. Ward's testimony demonstrating this task that we went through. There is a letter from the Sheriff's Association and the MPPOA and the county attorneys in support of this bill. It was a large and a diverse group, and it went on for months. And as Mr. Ward demonstrated in his testimony, it was a process that ended up with the bill before you. And as Chair Lesh noted, it's not perfect, and certain provisions cause concerns for some of our members, and that's the reflection of true compromise. We stand by this compromise. We appreciate the efforts of all those folks that Mr. Ward mentioned. There are 14 groups represented with multiple people from each of those groups, and we appreciate the efforts of all of those who worked so very hard to get to this consensus. And I'd also like to especially thank you, Chair Lesh, for your willingness to move this forward. and we appreciate that very much. We ask you members for your support. You will be hearing from Assistant St. Louis County Attorney who specializes in forfeiture work. She worked with us throughout this process along with another asset forfeiture specialist, and she will walk through the bill. And after that, she and I will be available for any questions. So thank you very much, Chair Lish.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Small. Ms. Sandstead, please proceed. Introduce yourself first, please.
Thank you, Chair Lish. My name is Nora Sandstead. I am an assistant St. Louis County attorney here in Duluth. I've been handling forfeitures for the county for the past 6 years. We work with about 20 different law enforcement agencies across St. Louis County to cover forfeiture for most of what they do in terms of felonies and misdemeanors. I wanted to take a little step back in terms of talking about forfeiture to just put some context of why we do this in the first place. The purpose of civil forfeiture is to deter crime by seizing the instruments of the crime or the proceeds of the crime, depending on what we're talking about. And the big elements here are DWIs and controlled substance crimes. So when we're seizing instruments of the crime, it's a vehicle used to commit a DWI, or it's a vehicle used to transport controlled substances. Proceeds are generally cash seized in terms of a controlled substance forfeiture. Why do we do this? What's the purpose? It's to deter crime. We have a significant opioid problem in St. Louis County. Last year, we had over 230 overdoses within the county. And so there's a serious effort to reduce the crime related to heroin, and forfeiture is a good tool in that toolkit. So now I'm going to turn to the bill, and I'm going to touch on the areas where it will change how we currently practice forfeiture from the county attorney perspective.
Thank you. Sure, Lance.
So in terms of DWI forfeitures, the scope of what vehicles will be seized is narrowed under this proposal. Currently, vehicles are seized when a driver has a restricted license based on alcohol restriction, they're canceled, inimical to public safety, or they have a second degree or a felony charge. This proposal would narrow the scope to only felony DWI charges and second degrees if they are the third violation within 10 years. So it's definitely going to limit this to only multiple time offenders. And it will be a significant reduction in the number of DWI forfeitures overall. There's a change to the interlock provision that was new last year that provides for vehicles to, provides for owners to be able to get their vehicles back if they use interlock. It sort of pauses the forfeiture. The change would be that currently there is an optional bond requirement that law enforcement agencies get to decide whether or not to require when a vehicle is returned. The change in this proposal would be to eliminate that bond requirement, so there wouldn't be any money that would have to be put down by someone reclaiming their vehicle. And it also reduces the interlock availability for felon offenders, except those who are participating in treatment courts. There's a significant change to how forfeitures are contested for innocent owners. And this is based in large part in response to a court case that came down in the last few years, which was known as the Olson case, that the Supreme Court decided that we needed enhanced due process protections for innocent owners of vehicles in DWI cases. So the group worked together to come up with a process that would work for all sides. And that process is going to be that for innocent owners, instead of filing with the court, they simply have to notify the prosecuting authority in writing that they're challenging the forfeiture. Then it becomes the work of the county attorney or the city attorney to file a claim if they still want to contest the forfeiture, if they want to pursue the forfeiture, if they don't believe in that the person making the claim is in fact an innocent owner. A lot of forfeitures will end at that point when they are reviewed thoroughly, and they'll be returned to innocent owners. If there is a belief that there's a question of as to whether or not someone is an innocent owner, then the municipal attorney will have to file the claim with court, and then there will be a hearing set within 30 days. And the proposal lays out the standards for that hearing. So that meets those due process concerns that were raised with the Olson case. I think it will return, it'll result in more vehicles being returned much quicker to innocent owners. There was discussion briefly of the amendment regarding the notice of seizure that has been updated to reflect these changes in the process for challenging the forfeiture, so that it'll be more understandable for people who receive the notice when a vehicle is seized to know how to defend their rights to property. One other change is that there's a clarification in terms of vehicles towing and storage. The tow bill has to be paid as it would be with any vehicles that is towed away from a scene of an arrest, but the storage fees are going to be limited or reduced in most cases. There will be administrative forfeiture continuing in DWI cases when there is no challenge made. There's a small clarification to proceed spending, and then a provision of immunity for law enforcement who releases a vehicle back, discontinuing a forfeiture. So that is the major changes on DWI. I'm going to pause here a moment and see if Mr. Bass wants to add anything before I turn to the controlled substance.
Sure. Did you want to add anything, Mr. Bass?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I do not. Nora, you're doing a great job. Keep going.
Excellent. High praise from the ACLU. Go ahead, Ms. Sandstead.
Thank you, Chair. I think Mr. Bass would agree that this group worked pretty well together. It took a long time for us to come to these compromise positions, but it was an effort of understanding where everyone was coming from. And there were certainly, I wouldn't want to characterize it as having two sides. There were probably 12 different sides to this discussion. So it was a really interesting process. The bill with regard to controlled substances is going to set a threshold of $1,500 for seizures. So with a small exception, there won't be any currency seizures under $1,500 when someone is investigated or arrested for a controlled substance crime. The exception to that is when there's probable cause to believe that the money seized was money exchanged for the purchase of controlled substances. So that's going to narrow the scope of forfeitures of currency. It's also sort of redefining what property is subject to forfeiture. There was sort of a laundry list before, and now it's narrowed down to property that is an instrument of or represents the proceeds of the controlled substance offense. It's kind of a cleaner and more precise definition there. Vehicle forfeiture is going to be restricted under this proposal as well in controlled substance cases to those vehicles that are used in the transportation or exchange of controlled substances intended for sale. And this is a change that we implemented in St. Louis County a couple years back as a policy, and it reduces significantly the number of vehicles that are seized. So instead of any vehicle that has a felony amount of controlled substances being seized, like perhaps from someone who is an addict who has a small amount, but enough, their vehicle could be seized under existing law. And this law is going to say, no, we're targeting people who are selling or distributing controlled substances. We're not targeting addicts. So that's going to significantly reduce the number of vehicles that are seized for forfeiture. There also are the enhanced protections for innocent owners of vehicles, just like I laid out in the DWI section, that's going to apply also in vehicles for controlled substance forfeitures. There is a provision clarifying that law enforcement buy money will be returned to law enforcement sort of outside of the forfeiture process. There's clarification of the use of forfeiture proceeds. And again, administrative forfeiture remains for unchallenged seizures. I'll pause there before I talk about the reporting and federal sharing in case Mr. Bass wants to add anything.
Okay, Mr. Bass, anything there?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead, Ms. Ensign.
Thank you. The last few elements, there's a reporting requirement that exists already and it's enhanced under this proposal. It would add in the inclusion of federal forfeitures, federal sharing reporting. There are new requirements on the details of forfeitures and the resolution of forfeitures, as well as how forfeiture funds are used or property is used that's retained by law enforcement. Because of the additional requirements, the reporting requirement is changed from monthly to quarterly, and then that provision allows for the state auditor to audit forfeiture receipts and expenditures by local municipalities. There is a change with regard to federal sharing law that was another compromise element that just prohibits federal sharing if it would circumvent state law. And then the last element of this bill is a study that the legislative auditor would conduct on the efficacy of DWI forfeiture and the interlock provision, which would be provided to the legislature in 2024 under the timeline here. So that's sort of the details of the proposal, and I will remain available to answer any questions about practicalities and process.
Thank you, Ms. Sandstead. Question from members of the committee for Ms. Sandstead. I don't see any. Oh, wait a second. Okay, yeah, we're going to do it. We've got Lucero on the list, but we're going to do after the other testifiers, including after Chief Potts. So I think what we'll do now, unless you had anything else, Ms. Sandstead?
No, Chair, thank you.
Okay, let's go to Mr. Bass.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Howard Bass. I'm a private criminal defense attorney and member of the ACLU of Minnesota Board of Directors. Ms. Sandstead did such a marvelous job of detailing this legislation. There's not a lot for me to add, other than I want to emphasize that this compromise legislation, in our view, strikes the right balance between protecting people's civil liberties on one hand, and on the other hand, protecting people from repeat drunk drivers and drug dealers. This legislation focuses on individuals who pose a legitimate threat to public safety, repeat drunk drivers and drug dealers, as opposed to addicts or users. By doing so, it is our belief that the legislation better safeguards the civil liberties of all Minnesotans. And it was a very contentious process. It took months of discussions. Nobody walked out with completely happy with the final product. But together, we did not allow the perfect to become the enemy of the good. And we believe that this legislation corrects some problems in existing forfeiture law and is a great step forward in terms of reaching that balance between protecting the citizens of Minnesota and protecting their rights. And with that, I have no further comments, but we'll be available for any questions.
Great. Thank you very much for that testimony, Mr. Bass. Members, we're going to move to testifier with concerns. That's Chief Potts, the Bloomington Police Chief. And after that, we'll do some committee discussion or questions from any of the testifiers. Go ahead, introduce yourself for the record, Chief Potts, and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Jeff Potts. I am the police chief in the city of Bloomington and the current president of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. I'm here speaking on behalf of the association, which is more than 300 police chiefs across the state of Minnesota. And Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if you're referring to our association as one of the malcontents who was not able to come to agreement on this, but I'd like to just clarify that we believe we're very reasonable and responsible partners in this process. I'd like to begin by saying our association is strongly in favor of forfeiture reform. Reform that focuses on three core principles, improving public awareness and understanding of the use of proceeds by police and prosecutors, promoting consistent standards by which vehicles and cash are forfeited from criminals in every community, ensuring reasonable, affordable legal remedies are available and to those who have their vehicles or cash forfeited, and for those who are innocent owners. Our association did actually take part in the forfeiture reform discussions that took place over the last several months. We were very grateful to have a seat at the table. We'd like to thank all the individuals and organizations who were involved in these talks. We felt they were very productive and very respectful. The County Attorneys Association definitely deserves special recognition for their leadership during these very difficult compromise in negotiations. We worked hard to find a compromise, a solution that balanced the protection of the people's personal rights, yet acknowledges the positive attributes of forfeiture laws, laws that we believe help keep impaired drivers off the roads and drug dealers out of our communities. There were parts of the bill that we support. We think that the recidivism study to track efficacy of forfeiture and ignition interlock is much needed. We believe additional protections for innocent owners is definitely a step in the right direction. And we are in favor of the reporting requirements for forfeiture property and the use of revenue. We believe that the ability for local law enforcement to utilize the federal sharing program is a must. However, there were a few areas, not very many, as it is written right now, that we think failed to prioritize traffic safety and ignore the realities of the drug trade, which continues to wreak havoc in communities of all sizes across the state. First, we believe this bill will result in at least a 50% decrease in DWI forfeitures. What's concerning about this is that this bill eliminates forfeitures for someone who is caught driving impaired and has a driver's license canceled to is defined or labeled as canceled, inimical to public safety, or has a no use restriction. While other aggregating factors are eliminated by the bill, these two provisions are the most troubling. Inimical to public safety is a description that refers to those drivers in Minnesota who have been found to be unable to safely utilize their vehicle without presenting a serious danger to others. Licenses that are canceled as inimical to public safety occur when that driver has been deemed to pose too great of a risk to others to allow them, him or her, to continue driving. A restricted driver's license with the no drug or alcohol restriction is commonly referred to in Minnesota as a B card. This type of license gives the repeat DWI offender the chance to regain a valid license to drive even after cancellation, typically after 3 DWI violations in a 10-year period or 4 DWI incidents in a lifetime. The primary goal of this restriction is to prevent individuals with multiple DWI convictions from drinking and getting behind the wheel. These are some of the most dangerous drivers that we have on the road today. In many instances, forfeiture is the only way or only deterrent tool left in the toolbox. The current proposal allows for someone who could be receiving their vehicle back after 2 weeks to pick that vehicle up and would not incur any charges. Our members feel that the storage costs are excessive. The MCPA respectfully requests that the language be modified to a 1 week storage. We believe this would allow for sufficient time for a person to make arrangements to pick up the vehicle. Lastly, on the DWI portion, without any responsibility for offenders to actually complete the ignition interlock process, this will dramatically set us back in the strides we've made in traffic safety. We believe that there should be language included that requires the person to successfully complete the ignition interlock program if this is essentially being done as an alternative to forfeiture. For those reasons, we don't support the DWI changes as they're currently written. We feel that there are some relatively minor changes that could be made for us to get that support. For the proposed changes to the drug forfeiture laws, we're deeply concerned about the threshold, the cash threshold of $1,500. We believe it will be debilitating, it will be a debilitating impact on law enforcement's ability to cut off the flow of money from dealers on the street and their drug bosses. The drug kingpins' ability to cut off the flow of money from dealers on the street and their bosses. The drugs oftentimes are coming from many of these folks receive their drug supply from suppliers outside of the United States. The most effective way to remove drugs from a community, to keep the drugs out of our schools and away from our kids, is to reduce the demand as well as disrupt the supply, which is often done by disrupting the cash flow to the source of the drugs. Contrary to what some people believe, a drug dealer with $1,500 amount of drugs is not a small-time dealer. This is true in big cities and even more so in small towns. For context, let's talk about the current drug prices. They're low. A drug dealer can buy an ounce of heroin for $1,500. An ounce is 28.35 grams. The typical user amount of heroin is 1/10 of 1 gram. Using these numbers, $1,500 equals more than 283 individual user amounts of heroin. Fentanyl is basically the same price, but it is 25 to 50 times stronger than heroin. In Hennepin County alone, my county, fentanyl-related deaths continue to rise, mirroring the national trend. At least 135 people died from fentanyl or fentanyl analog overdoses in Hennepin County in 2019. This is a tenfold increase from the number of fatally overdoses in 2015. The opioid crisis may have taken a slight backseat during the COVID-19 crisis, but make no mistake about it, now is not the time to make it easier for criminals to sell illicit drugs, profit from the illegal activities, and find a haven in Minnesota. I'll wrap up my testimony with this. It's important to understand that property seized in Minnesota under current forfeiture laws, such as drugs and money, and vehicles driven in drunk driving cases, must be connected to ongoing criminal behavior. Current law allows for a person to engage in a simple process and be heard in either conciliation or district court about why the property should be forfeited. Current law also allows for a person to talk with a prosecutor without the need to start litigation. In the end, this bill dismantles the forfeiture process. It will result in the return of illegal proceeds or instruments of the crime to convicted criminals. The proposed changes would make forfeitures difficult to prove, very time-consuming, and costly for law enforcement, that forfeitures may diminish to near nothing. If that is the ultimate intent of the bill, then we predict that it will be successful. However, we don't feel that that outcome is what's best in the best interest for public safety. We respectfully ask that the items that we oppose be reconsidered so that we can support the bill. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for your time here, and I will stand for any questions.
Thank you, Chief Potts. My apologies. I did not mean to offend you at all by casually bandying about the term malcontent. You were one of several. You weren't the only group that doesn't like the compromise negotiated here, so I offer you my apology if you were offended by that. I do have a question for you, and I'm going to see if there are other questions. I know that Representative Lucero is on the list, Representative O'Neill, Representative Mahler. I recall a letter that you sent me last year saying you agreed to a money threshold at $2,500. So I'm trying to figure out here now that the threshold in the bill is at $1,500, and now you're saying that you would want a lower threshold, but the threshold I have you on is saying that you would want a higher threshold. So can you tell me what threshold are you looking for?
Mr. Chair and members, the Minnesota Chiefs Association as an individual association, I don't recall supporting in a letter $2,500. If you have that and can remind us of the details of it, I'd certainly be interested in looking back at that. But I think our association is it's difficult right now to say that we accept a threshold of X. What we do agree to is that there were many cases that were discussed in these here, in these negotiation sessions or compromise sessions where there were $25 or $40 seized. We agreed that there needs to be a threshold at some point. What we have, and maybe even since last year, if in fact there were indications that $2,500 was supported, I think if anything has changed, we're trying to recognize the current drug trade in our communities and how much $1,500 in specifically heroin buys you today that might have been different even a year ago. And so I think we're trying to kind of take into account and consideration current drug trade in our communities and how devastating heroin, fentanyl cases have been from the standpoint of overdoses. So I don't think that $1,500 is where our association is at in terms of what we can support. But I also would say we'd like to get back together and have one last conversation about this. I don't think we're that far off. We're not suggesting we go down to what had been being done in many cases throughout the state. You know, over the last few years, we agree that there should be a threshold. We're just not comfortable saying that $1,500 in light of current drug prices is the right place.
So, Chief Potts, I wondered, you know, my forfeiture bill that I have from last year, I think you're familiar with it. Would you have preferred that my original forfeiture bill go through, or do you think that this compromise is better for you, for your organization?
Well, I think, Chair Lashton, members, that there are definitely parts of this that the compromise is better than it was last year. And I want to reiterate, I think there are a lot of things in this bill that we agree to. There are just a small kind of handful of things that when we went back to our members to ask them our position on this, that they're just not there. Now, I would agree that it is a compromise bill. It's better, in fact, than what was presented last year. We just respectfully ask the opportunity to come back together and try to work on the small number of issues that I just highlighted in hopes that we could get to a point where we support this just like everybody else on the list of names that you read off earlier.
Chief Potts, I last question for you. Do you have any specific suggestions for improving the DWI changes? So do you have data, for example, that shows lower recidivism when DWI vehicles are forfeited? And do you support the study that we've included in this bill to understand the correlation between DWIs and forfeiture and recidivism?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Yes, we do support, and I think that was in the testimony. We think the recidivism study to track the efficacy of forfeiture and ignition interlock is much needed. There were a couple items that I added in the testimony that I think would help us to a point where we support the DWI portion. And I've mentioned those. I'll kind of reiterate a couple of them at least here. And I think the area that is probably most problematic is the forfeiture for those who have been considered inimical to public safety or who have other restrictions. And those designations are concerning to us that those are multiple time offenders. There may be cases where they are less than three convictions, but there are definitely some of those cases that are concerning to us that would not allow for forfeiture. And we think that in some of those cases, forfeiture is really the only way to keep that person from, you know, from being on the roadway in the vehicle. The one item I talked about there was the storage, that the responsibility of their agency being responsible for 2 weeks of those storage fees is concerning. And I'm trying to remember back, Mr. Chair, on what the third item was. I can circle back to that here in a few minutes, just a couple seconds, if you'd allow me to review my notes.
Sorry, I got to unmute myself here. It's nice that Zoom puts a message up to remind me that I'm muted. So I guess while you're reviewing that, we can go to questions from folks on the list, and right now I have Lucero, O'Neill, Mahler, Johnson, and Liebling. So, I'm not disappointed by your choice in blouse, Representative Lucero. It's still pretty loud. Go ahead with your question.
Not a blouse, Mr. Chair, but thank you for the compliment. Yes, I was so excited to vote for this, not because it's a perfect bill, which it's not. As we heard from multiple testifiers, there's definitely compromise all the way around. That I initially raised my hand to call for a roll, but then I was reminded that there is a roll call already. So that was the primary purpose. But I would also just say that I think the entire time I've been had the privilege of serving in this capacity, which is 6 years now, this issue has been one that has been a continued conversation. So I have been a co-author on multiple iterations of this bill in one form or another. And while I'm not right now a co-author on this bill that you recently introduced, I am going to ask myself to be a co-author. So thank you, Chair Lesh, and thank you for all the stakeholders that have put time into this, because I firmly believe that one should be held innocent until proven guilty, and that their private property should follow like kind. So again, not a perfect bill, but definitely a large step in the right direction. So thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. Representative O'Neill, I think, is the next one. I'm sorry, no, Representative Mahler is the next one. Representative Mahler?
Yep, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, too, want to thank all the stakeholders for your hard work in putting this bill together. It was no easy task, and I really appreciate all the effort that you had worked into this. I have a couple of questions related to the DWI provisions, and perhaps Ms. Sandstead can answer some of those concerns that were raised by Chief Potts, especially the cancellation as inimical to public safety. I haven't really done any of those, but it's my understanding that a lot of those folks who are canceled as IPS are probably going to qualify under the multiple DWI provisions anyway. And so if you could just address that, am I wrong about that?
Ms. Hanson.
Thank you, Chair Lesh. Thank you for the question, Representative Mahler. Yes, there would be a significant overlap in the people whose vehicles are seized because they have, because they're drunk driving, with a license that's canceled inimical to public safety or has a alcohol restriction on it, and the people who are either having third and 10 or felony level DWIs. So we're not going to be stopping forfeiture from all folks who have canceled licenses. It's only those, now there's a small number that occur that are people who have a license restriction or canceled license from maybe 15, 20 years ago, and they've never updated that. And it's their first DWI in 8 years. Those vehicles would not be seized for forfeiture anymore under the new provision, unless the person also qualifies as having three within the last 10 years or is a felon, or this is a felon level because of a prior felony.
Thank you. Representative Mahler?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have one other question. Another concern was related to the ignition interlock provisions. And I think, Chief Potts, you had said that you were concerned that somebody who failed or didn't complete that interlock program then wouldn't be subject, their vehicle wouldn't be subject to forfeiture. But as I read the language, and I'm looking specifically around lines 10.13, I'm seeing that you have to, if you don't complete that program or you terminate from the program, your vehicle then would be subject to forfeiture. And I know we had some discussions about this interlock provisions last year when we had a different bill that was enacted. And so if you could please address that for me.
Chief Potts.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members, I guess I would defer to, it's my understanding currently that that doesn't specifically require the completion. So I would, Mr. Chair, direct that question to Ms. Sandstead for a clarification, as it was described to me that there are ways in which someone could begin the internet interlock program but not complete it. I'd like to, Mr. Chair, see if you would be open to Ms. Sandstead kind of clarifying that issue.
Sure, Ms. Sandstead.
Thank you, Chair. So I can do my best, but this is new legislation that is now 8 months, 9 months old. And in St. Louis County, anyway, we've had just a handful of these interlock cases in the last year, or since August, since it went into effect. In theory, my understanding is that if someone bails out of the interlock program for some reason, the forfeiture would be able to essentially resume where it was left off. I think in practice, I know that there are some agencies that we partner with that when someone comes in and says, okay, I've signed up for interlock, I want my vehicle back, they're given the vehicle back and the forfeiture is just discontinued because the agency doesn't want to administratively follow the vehicle any further. So the application of the interlock provision is not consistent across all agencies, but I believe in theory, unsuccessfully or not successfully completing interlock could allow the resumption of a forfeiture.
Thank you. Representative Mahler?
That's it, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for that clarification.
Thank you. Representative O'Neill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have a question for you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the fiscal note, and it looks like it's a small fiscal note, but we do have an increase of an FTE to the public Department of Public Safety of 1.5 in this fiscal, and then in the tails, it's a 4.6 increased FTEs. And I didn't really hear what that was for. Maybe you could speak to why the Department of Public Safety needs a
So I had that conversation, but it's now too long ago to remember what the answer was. So I'm going to defer to Mr. Walls, if you can answer that for me, Mr. Walls.
Mr. Chair, John Walls from House Fiscal Staff. The Department of Public Safety is requesting one additional person for record keeping within the state patrol. They're seeking $82,000 a year in trunk highway fund. They feel that the changes in the bill will require some additional record keeping, and they need one additional position for that. In addition to that, there is some auditing required of the state auditor, and they were asking for two positions to do the audits of prosecuting authorities and law enforcement as required by the bill as well.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the tails, it actually says 4.6 FTEs, not two. So maybe there's an error in the fiscal note or public safety's updating it or something, but it seems like it's a little bit bigger than that.
Mr. Walls, can you address that?
Mr. Chair, the fiscal note is that I'm looking at, it's she's looking at a total by year, and so the auditor is asking for in the tails 1.3, and the Department of Public Safety is one for a total of 2.3. They shouldn't be totaled together. That's just an ongoing tally, and 2.3 FTEs is the max when fully implemented.
Does that answer your question, Representative O'Neill?
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Next, we have Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesch, first of all, I want to thank you and all those who worked on this over the past year. This issue is brought up every year and is always contentious from both sides of the aisle. Although there are some provisions in the bill that I don't agree with, and I understand and agree with the concerns of the Chiefs of the Police Association, I also understand that there is a lot of compromise on both sides of this issue to bring this compromise forward. So I'm going to be supporting the bill at this time, and I do hope that this issue will be put to bed for several years. In the 10 years that I've been down here, We've dealt with it for 10 years. Every year we've dealt with it. And I'm hoping that we can put this to bed for at least until we get that report back to see what's going on. It'd be a nice next biennium not to have to put up with this. So thank you for doing this. And like I say, I want to thank all those that worked hard.
Understood. Thank you, Chair Johnson. And that is the point of why we try to reach compromise. Hopefully there's enough buy-in from everyone that we sit back. No one's totally happy, but we take this off the committee calendar again for a little while to get to some other work we need to do. We are running out of time, and we have one last comment or question from Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I want to echo everybody's appreciation for all the hard work. I have been a forfeiture skeptic, I would say, for a very long time. I'm really pleased to see some of these issues moving toward being resolved. The question that I have, one of the things that's always concerned me about forfeiture, or at least in recent years, has been that that law enforcement actually was able to utilize the proceeds of some of the proceeds that were gained from forfeiture. And in addition, that prosecutors, prosecutorial agencies also got a cut of the proceeds from forfeiture. And that's always been of great concern to me, because I think it what it does is it undermines confidence in law enforcement. It creates an appearance of conflict of interest, even if in fact there is none. That appearance is very troubling. So my question is, to what degree this bill changes any of that? I understand this is still allowing some of those proceeds to be used, but if anybody could just clarify that for me quickly, that would be helpful. Maybe the person from the County Attorneys Association who gave the great overview, if you could.
Ms. Anstead? Ms. Anstead, did you want to address that?
Sure, I can. Thanks, Chair, and thank you, Representative Liebling, for that question. There isn't a change to the allocation of funds, but in the reporting requirements, there are now new requirements in this bill as to reporting how the forfeiture funds are being spent by those entities that receive the proceeds, with some significant detail involved. And that will go into the annual auditor's report. So I think that there will be a lot more data to look at in the next few years in terms of how those funds are spent and allocated that could be useful in future discussions.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that. And I have to say, I think that is troubling. And I would really like to see that go away. And then we could have, I think, more of a full discussion about forfeiture itself without any of those kind of concerns in there. So I understand the desire to get this off the plate and move on to other topics, but I have to say, personally, as long as that's still there, it's still going to be a concern, at least for this member. So thank you very much for your answers.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. The motion is that House File 4551, as amended by the two amendments, be recommended to be re-referred to State Government Finance. The clerk, committee legislative assistant, will take the roll.
Chair Lesh.
Aye.
Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Albright.
Aye.
Representative Barr.
Aye.
Representative Cantrell.
Aye.
Representative Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Considine.
Aye.
Representative Hassan.
Aye.
Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Lucero.
Yes.
Representative Mariani.
Yes.
Representative Noor.
Yes.
Representative O'Neill.
Aye.
Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Representative Zhang.
Aye.
There being 18 ayes and zero nays, the motion prevails and House File 4571 as amended is recommended to be re-referred to State Government Finance Committee. Again, I want to relay my thanks and gratitude to everyone who really worked hard at this and didn't get all of what they wanted, but I don't know. I got a lot of respect for you for doing that. This is a tough job and you pulled it off. So everyone who was involved in those negotiations, thank you. You save a lot of work for the legislature when you do that. So our last bill is House File 3563, Representative Moran. And I want the record to reflect for my CA that we are 5 minutes ahead of schedule, according to your schedule. So I'm pretty happy about that. This is child support modifications. It was originally scheduled to be heard the week of deadlines, and with the pandemic canceling our hearings, we're now trying to get some important bills moved that can help folks. So I move that House File 3563 be recommended to be re-referred to HHS Finance, and Representative Moran has a DE7 amendment. I will move the DE7 amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author desires. Any comment on the DE7 amendment? I'm not seeing any. And by the way, members, if you know, I skip past that because I don't see any and you got one and you're freaking out trying to get word out, we'll go back to you and we'll reconsider something if need be. So we have the DE7 amendment in front of us. All in favor of the DE7 amendment, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, signify by saying no. The motion passes and the DE7 amendment is adopted. Representative Moran, please tell us about your bill as amended.
All right. Thank you, Chair Lesh and members. I want to thank you for the opportunity to present to you the DE amendment to the to House File 35. In preparation to hearing this bill today, I would like to give thank you to Representative Scott for her support and leadership in getting this bill to a place of moving in both bodies. Earlier this year, Ramsey County Attorney John Troy and staff in the Ramsey County Attorney Office asked me to carry legislation in support of the recommendations put forth by the Child Support Task Force. The Child Support Task Force was created in 2016 and included a diverse group of stakeholders to review and recommend changes to our current child support guideline table. The current child support guideline table has not been updated, had not been updated, since January 1, 2007. The task force first met in September of 2016 and they issued a final report in October of 2019. During this process, the task force engaged many experts, communities, and stakeholders regarding the proposed changes. The task force recommendation makes important improvement to the child support guidelines table to ensure fairness and equity for all families, but most importantly, for families in need. The members of the task force updated the current guidelines by making adjustment to the USDA cost estimates for child support expenses, in addition to other changes. The legislation is supported by the Minnesota Family Support and Recovery Council, the Minnesota Association of County Social Services Administration, and Ramsey County. Melissa Rosso, and Amy Anderson from Ramsey County Attorney Office are available to walk through the changes. Melissa Rosso served as a member of the Child Force Task Force, and Amy Anderson provided some critical support to the task force. So with that, Chair Lesh, I would like to pass this on to Melissa Rosso. And please pronounce your name for me, Melissa.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Rosso. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Moran, members. My name is Melissa Rosso. I was a member of the Child Support Guidelines Task Force representing the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. Representative Scott was also a member of that task force for those almost 2.5 years, where we worked through a lot of interesting issues, had a lot of really important discussions, particularly with members of the public. On behalf of my county, Ramsey County, we felt that it was very important to bring the recommendation of the task force forward as soon as possible so that we could get our guidelines updated for the people that are using the child support guidelines. This includes a lot of lower income people, but really spans the whole economic, socioeconomic makeup of the state of Minnesota. And there is some important fixes in the guidelines table in particular, which is the focus of this bill in the guidelines table, the background numbers, and how it affects the people that are subject to the guidelines table. Amy Anderson, an assistant Ramsey County attorney, as Representative Moran stated, provided excellent services to the task force. Amy not only is an assistant county attorney in Ramsey County assigned to the child support area, but she's also a certified public accountant. And she loves numbers and she loves economics. So when I approached her after the first meeting and said, hey, will you start coming and start providing some technical assistance to the task force as we need it? She jumped right in. So, Mr. Chair, Representative Moran, I am asking to turn over the explanation of the bill to Amy Anderson.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Rosso. Ms. Anderson, please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and members. My name is Amy Anderson. As Ms. Rosso indicated, I'm an assistant in Ramsey County, and I've been doing child support enforcement for Ramsey County for 25 years. I'm also a CPA, as she indicated, and I just finished my 40th tax busy season. Well, not quite finished because of the pandemic that's going on, but yes, I've been doing it for that long. As she indicated, the primary purpose of the bill is to update the basic support table. Since the table went into effect when our income shares legislation went into effect in 2007, it's never been updated. And that has made it apparent to everybody who does child support enforcement in Minnesota that something needs to change. I was not on the task force, but as Ms. Rosso indicated, I did attend the meetings and provide some assistance. I end up one of the people behind the numbers in the bill that's before you. When the current guidelines came into effect in 2007, I noticed right away that I didn't think some of the numbers were really fair to people that were especially in low incomes. There was too high a percentage of their income that was being expected to go to child support. And this was especially true for the cases where there are multiple children. The percentage of a person's gross income that was expected to go to child support was way too high. For families that had six or more children, the table went up as far as 75% of their gross income. I'm a mother of four children myself, and I know that as we had our fourth child, we didn't spend another 16%, which is what the table provides for, on that next child. But that is the way the current table was constructed when it was built in 2007. The table has also gotten more difficult for people who are low-income wage earners, because as the cost of living has gone up over the years, the lower end of the table is requiring more and more of their income towards child support. So since I've been complaining about the table for all those years, I was asked to provide some background to the task force exactly about what the problems were. Also what's happened along the way since 2007 is that people like me that do child support have learned a lot about what is an effective way to get child support into children's hands. There was a study out of Orange County, California that indicated if your child support is more than 20% of your gross income, you're not likely to be able to collect that amount. On the current table, there's a range of incomes where support for one child is more than 25%, and for two children, it's up to 39%. While there are some people out there that are critics of the study, a lot of us who work in child support realize it's much better to get an order that is within the obligor's ability to pay that support than to get a high order. If the order is set at the right size, obligors have a much better record on paying regularly and consistently. So we've determined that it's not very much good to set orders that aren't collectible. We have also heard and can see from talking to the people that come to court that we see on a regular basis, that it is better for them to get an amount that's received consistently, even if it's lower. The thing about the current guidelines is they don't really recognize the needs of the person who is paying the support. What we need are guidelines that recognize both the custodial household and the ability of the obligor to pay. Back to what happened at the task force. After my first presentation to them, what kind of laid out for them what the problems I thought with the current guidelines were. I continue to attend all the meetings and occasionally assist them as they work through problems. There were several potential tables provided by the economist that was hired by the task force. She's the other person behind the numbers, Dr. Renor. But even in the last version of her table, both the task force and the economist said, we still haven't dealt with low-income obligors. And no one really had a good feel on how to do that. Eventually, because I told the task force I could do it, they said, okay, Amy, you run with it. You see what you can do with this to fix the numbers. There were a lot of factors that went into my adjustments of those numbers for the lower part of the table. And I was really surprised myself at the end at how low I had the numbers to get to go to make it all work out, to fit within what we've learned from the Orange County study. Now in the table that I have proposed and that is part of this bill, the highest level of support as a percentage of gross income is at $6,000 per month. Under the prior table, it was at $2,000 per month. And the percentage for one child is 16.5%. It never gets higher than that. And it's on an upgrade, a slope up onto that to get to 6,000 and then down again on the other side. After adjusting that part of the table, the task force then asked me to make the other adjustments that were needed to the table. I built out the table to go from the 1 to 3 that the economist had by to add for 4, 5, and 6 children. And then I also increased the overall limit to $30,000 per month of combined income. That was in the original bill, and as the amendment that has been discussed today, that brings that lower amount down to $20,000. Besides the bill itself, there are a few other items that Ramsey County thought were really important about the task force work that we wanted to include with this bill. And they relate to creating more equity between the parties' children.
And Ms. Anderson,
yes.
If I could ask you to go on a good clip, our TV shuts off at 2:15, and we still have to vote on the bill. And we got a couple questions from members, so I'm going to ask you to wrap it up.
Okay, I will do that. Just briefly, the other issues that we looked at were to deal with non-joint children. And the detail is in the bills, but it's an issue that was really important, and so Ramsey County brought that forward. So if there are any other questions, Chair Lesh, I appreciate the ability to speak to you all. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Anderson. And we also have Diane Anderson here, who's available for questions if needed. I won't introduce her to speak, but it's not a Minnesota hearing unless you have more than one Anderson on the record. So thank you for contributing to that. Representative Scott. Chair Scott.
Thank, Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to thank the folks with Ramsey County and Legal Aid that worked together on this bill as well. And it's not perfect, but I think that it's progress. And I just want to speak real briefly to the other section of the bill, and that relates to the child care portion of child support, which is set at the initial, when child support is set through the court system. And what we did, there's not a really good way in current law for the obligor, which is the person that pays the child support. There's not a good way for them to know when the child care amount has been decreased or has gone away altogether. And we all know that children age out of child care, or if they go from a private in-home child care to a larger child care center, that the prices vary, or if they go the opposite way of that too. So this bill provides a better path for obligors to find out that the child care expenses have decreased or changed. I guess that's the operative word here, is changed, and allows them then a path forward to get a modification if that need be. So I wanted to address that issue too. And also, as a member of the Child Support Task Force, I wanted to make sure that members of the committee and of the public are aware that they can go online and read the minority report, which I signed as well. There are some things from the Child Support Task Force in the overall report that I wasn't in agreement with, but people can read the minority and the majority report there. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Scott. Representative Mahler.
Thank you. And I'm going to support this bill, but I do have some concerns about lines 12.19 to 12.24. And I think, Representative Scott, those were was kind of the area you were talking about with some circumstances changing for folks. And I just want to point out that child care providers change throughout the course of a child growing up. I have two teenagers, and I can tell you that it's not just a child going to a center or a family home daycare situation. In my own circumstance, I thought about this. We had four different centers, school-based care, camps in the summertime, a nanny, different drivers, summer sitters, and after-school sitters. There were some times when it felt like the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker to make all of our child care needs happen. And I think that the bill, and actually maybe just the statute in general, not specific to this bill, kind of treats child care providers as being a one-time provider or center where you're moving from infant care to toddler care to preschool care. And so I guess, you know, that language still concerns me, but I think it's better than what it had been in some other additions of this bill I had seen. I do have a question, though, about line 12.21. It says that if there's a change in the child care provider, the type of provider, or the age group, the obligee must give the obligor an updated document. And I'm just wondering if there are any timelines surrounding when that document must be provided.
So, Representative Mahler, we have, now 60 seconds to get this bill out and vote. So that's a yes or no question. Could you receive those answers offline?
Yep, no problem. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Then the motion is that House File 3563, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the HHS Finance Committee. The committee legislative assistant will take the roll. Chair votes aye.
Representative Mahler.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Albright.
Aye.
Representative Barr.
Aye.
Representative Cantrell.
Aye.
Representative Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Considine.
I'm going to vote aye. I had a question, and I'll try to maybe connect with you, Chair Lesh.
Representative Hassan.
Aye.
Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling.
Abstain.
Representative Lucero.
Yes.
Representative Mariani.
Aye.
Representative Knorr.
Aye.
Representative O'Neill.
Aye.
Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Representative Zhang.
Aye.
On a vote of 17 ayes and one abstention, the motion prevails. House File 3563 as amended is re-referred to HHS Finance. Members, thank you. Apologize, Chair Constant, we couldn't get to your question. Hopefully you can get that out and we can get questions answered from the experts we have here, Ms. Anderson and Ms. Russo. We'll get that, those answers back to you. Members, we may be conducting future remote hearings that will be noticed on our committee page. Until then, this remote hearing, the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee is adjourned.